It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's largest solar project is fully operational. Wisconsin Public Service says the 830,000 solar panels move and track the sun throughout the day, maximizing power generation and providing enough energy to power roughly 90,000 homes. As we examine the future of solar, call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Hyla is Executive Director of Midwest Renewable Energy Association, which is based in Custer, Wisconsin, working with organizations on solar energy education and market development. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And we have Larry Susskind with us, professor of urban and environmental planning at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, founded the Consensus Building Institute. Larry, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And Larry, starting with you, as we see our country having this boom in solar energy farms, as solar, you know, becomes more affordable and concerns about climate change are growing, but we're also seeing these conflicts bubbling up over where to place these solar farms. What is causing these conflicts?
It's not so much where to place them that people are fighting about. It's once decisions are made about where they're going to go, how big they're going to be, what the technology is, and all the other details, then they're announced. And people are finding out that the developers have made on the proposals that really ignore the adverse effects. And there are adverse effects on a small number of people. And the question is, should the rest of us say, well, too bad, some people are going to be adversely affected? Or should we have a discussion at the beginning as people are thinking about where and how to design these and say, who's going to be adversely affected and how can we hold them harmless? How can we mitigate or compensate the adverse effects? And in most states, the siting process doesn't start a conversation early enough so that people who are worried that something bad's going to happen to them have no choice but to be against the facility. That could be avoided.
It could be avoided if there was early buy-in in the process and that any shortcomings would be acknowledged and figured out much earlier on?
Yes, and I think that we have examples of what we call community benefit agreements, negotiated terms what the developer promises to help the community cover the costs that are created for it locally, usually for a big facility in a rural area. They're building the facility so that people in the city who are quite a ways away can have a lower cost clean energy. That's great, except they're leaving the costs on the individuals without having a discussion about how they could be minimized.
So, Nick, as you hear this, where do you see resistance to solar farms in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think Professor Susskind makes good points. I think it's important to understand that, you know, the large-scale solar development doesn't result from some sort of intensive centralized planning process. And it's mostly driven by developers who are using their information as to where there's capacity in the grid, where there's flat land, where there may be willing landowners, and to points made previously, all of this happens for the most part out of public eye. And so these projects do come as a surprise often to local communities. It should be noted, in every state in the Midwest now, with recent legislation passed in Michigan and also Illinois, every state now, the Public Utility Commission is responsible for the approvals of these facilities and much of the local control of where and how they're sited has been now brought to the state capitol with appointed regulators. There are methods by which communities can engage in this process to maximize benefit, as was mentioned, with joint development agreements or community benefit agreements. And to get more, I guess, specifically to your question, where you see resistance, you know, these facilities bring really remarkable economic benefits to the local townships and counties where they're sited through energy tax revenue that's distributed, and that's quite significant. In Wisconsin, it's, you know, every facility that's 50 megawatts or bigger, and thinking of, you know, solar farm size, 1 megawatt is about 5 to 6 acres. And so you think about a 50 megawatt facility, you know, you're looking at a relatively significant amount of acreage. And it also brings revenue to the landholders where the farm is sited. And that can be very consistent and high per acre revenue for over 40 years. And so it's not often the farmers or landowners where the farm is sited that are resisting. It's more the neighboring landowners that aren't receiving the direct benefit.
Who don't have direct interests in it.
Right.
Yeah, economic impacts. Nick Hyla at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, Larry Susskind at MIT, as we talk about solar farms in Wisconsin and beyond, and hear from you. Call in with a question or comments at 800-642-1234. Larry, The Atlantic, in an article, faults environmentalists and civic groups for demanding too much public review on clean energy projects and causing delays in decarbonization. Are review processes like the public service commissions at large, are they causing holdups in approving solar energy?
I think that's silly. We've studied more than 53 instances of projects that have been stopped from one end of the country to the other. We're looking at all kinds of renewable energy projects. And when we got up close and looked at why those were delayed or blocked, it's because nobody bothered to take account of significant issues. Tribes were not consulted. There's a law that says if you're building on tribal land, the tribe has to be consulted. They weren't. So the people designing these facilities, usually from away, looking at a map and looking at, you know, solar or wind resources, picked a spot that happened to be sacred area. So, of course, the tribe is going to cause delay because it was nobody talked to them early. The delay is the product of most of our state siting laws not requiring a serious conversation, not a hearing after decisions are made, but a conversation before decisions are made. We have a clinic at MIT that we offer free assistance to communities. We worked in Michigan in the fall on two large solar projects. The end result of one of those projects was the municipality used its zoning power to try to keep the project out because too many people were going to be paying costs that nobody talked to them about, the issues of infrastructure and water. And while I agree with Nick that some landowners are going to be really happy because they can rent or sell their property and make more than they were making with whatever they were growing, as he pointed out, all the surrounding landowners aren't getting anything. And if there's going to be a loss of property value with the industrialization, as some people say, of what was a purely rural area, or certainly the visual impact if they don't put appropriate barriers around it for people that live in a place, or effects on the water supply. We just had a case this week in Massachusetts where a solar facility high on a hill, believe it or not, was cut down all the trees, getting ready to put in their equipment. And there was a big rainstorm, and nobody had created any retention ponds that worked. And all the water came pouring down the hill because the trees weren't there to the root take responsibility for stopping that. And it completely flooded the whole community at the bottom. And the developer says, hey, look, we have our license. We're allowed to build here. That's crazy. There's the delay that's a product of an effort to stop because nobody will listen or respond. The notion that Michigan then passed a law like New York and California, again, as Nick suggested, preempting all local involvement for large-scale facilities. Well, we haven't had the first instance yet of the state hearing that's going to take the place of all the local involvement that there was. I don't think it's going to stop the delay. I think, as Nick implied, they're going to just move the resistance in a more sophisticated way to the state level.
Larry Susskind, urban and environmental planning professor at MIT. Nick Hyla is with us as well, heads up the Wisconsin-based Midwest Renewable Energy Association, as we discuss solar energy's evolution, where to put it. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Nature Conservancy cites over half of large businesses and employers across five Midwest states, including Wisconsin. They have ambitious greenhouse gas reduction targets, but they may be challenged without additional local renewable options. We examine the outlook for solar, and you can call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Larry Susskind is an urban and environmental planning professor at MIT and heads up the Consensus Building Institute. Nick Hyla leads the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Nick, we heard from Sandy in Lake Geneva, called in to ask, can the land around the panels on these solar farms be used to grow crops? What are the options?
Yeah, that's a growing field of research with some significant efforts even at the UW-Madison researching that. And I think the short answer is not yet. And maybe backing up a little bit, these decisions don't exist in a vacuum, right? As we are in this situation all across the United States where we are seeing how expensive it is to continue to own and operate much of our baseload generation, nuclear and coal. These facilities are at the end of their life, and the decisions of the Public Utility Commission based on cost and reducing cost of ratepayers have really focused on solar and wind energy development because the fuel is free and it's mostly an investment in steel and not in securing limited fossil fuel supplies throughout the life of the system. That represents a tremendous opportunity as we distribute these energy facilities across the landscape because these facilities bring revenue to communities that are desperately in need. But at the same time, they don't necessarily engage in a way that is transparent and open and collaborative with those communities to best site the farms. One obvious idea is to integrate them with agricultural practices, but the challenge there is you're taking this capital-intensive, calcified industry known as agriculture and trying to integrate it with another capital-intensive and calcified industry known as energy that have a lot of different layers of regulation and financing and infrastructure development. And it's absolutely feasible to integrate. Grazing is much more common under solar farms, and we're seeing that all across Wisconsin integrated. We're also seeing pollinator-friendly habitat, and that is part of this community benefits agreement process. For example, is you could require a developer to develop perennial grasses and wildflowers that prevent erosion and provide wildlife habitat. But crop production under large-scale solar facilities is a little more difficult, but very promising. And so I would say now you're not seeing a lot of it, but a lot of conversations are happening about the benefits there.
Feasible, but very complicated going forward. This month, Nancy from Wautoma called into us and expressed concern about large solar farms being developed on farmland.
There are huge tracts of farmland, huge. Mm-hmm. And there are two of them just within a couple of miles of each other that just went up in the Wautoma area. And we want to know why it had to go on farmland, why they can't use alternative sites.
Larry, should solar farms be put on buildings or over parking lots rather than on farmland?
It's a different kind of solar energy. Rooftop solar should go ahead. There are communities around the United States where you have publicly sponsored building on public building rooftops, and then that's extended to commercial and residential structures. But that scale is way different from what 1,000 acres and an industrial site, industrial scale solar site is going to give you. And if you need a lot of land, it's not going to be in the city. It could be that land is reused, right? Navajo is trying to build large-scale solar facilities on abandoned coal mines. They're trying to make a new positive use. And apropos of the previous caller, they're trying to combine the raising of sheep of the kind that have wool that they use to make the special Navajo blankets, by having the sheep maintain, as Nick implied, keeping the grass or whatever's growing low, so that the sheep herders have a way of generating some income. But coordinating that, as Nick pointed out, is no simple matter. That's why this community benefit agreement idea that both Nick and I mentioned very briefly really needs to be spelled out in state siting law. The new Michigan law says really just a couple of lines, and it says the developer should try to talk to the community and work something out and write a community benefits agreement. And if they show that they tried to talk to some local people and nobody wanted to talk to them, that's good enough. That's ridiculous. Every state siting law should be amended to require a community-wide conversation where the product is a contract that's signed between the local government and the developer and is submitted as part of the plan and thus becomes enforceable by the state siting council. And if you know that you have to have a community benefits agreement that seeks to meet the interests of all sides, those difficult negotiations will happen early, and they'll happen in a way that takes account of needs and interests that are being ignored. But there's no question that the largest of these facilities are going to be in rural areas because they need a huge amount of space and they want to get that land at the lowest cost they can. But it could be that reused land that was not good for anything else anymore, for whatever reason, could be the first choice within a larger region.
Larry Susskind there at MIT, Nick Hyla with us at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association as we talk about solar energy. Let's go to Bonnie in Deer Park. Bonnie, hi.
Hello. I am wondering.
Hi, Bonnie. Can you hear us?
Hi.
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm wondering how long a solar panel's life is, and then once it's no longer used, how is it recycled?
Thank you, Bonnie. How long does this technology last, Nick?
Yeah, so a typical solar module has a production warranty of 25 years, but are expected to last 30 to 40. If you look at the land lease agreements that are currently being signed across the Midwest, you're looking at 40-year agreements, so kind of like a expected 40-year lifespan. There's a lot of misinformation out there about, the contents of a solar module and whether it's recyclable. So maybe we'll just address that quickly.
Very quickly, yes.
Yeah, modules are basically glass, aluminum, copper, and plastic. They're very simple, and polysilicon, which is the electricity producing part of the module. And right now there's research all across the country and very successful processes to basically strip those modules apart into their reusable components. And that is a priority in the industry. So we are seeing and expect to see as these facilities are installed. And again, this is often part of the decommissioning requirements of these plans, is to disassemble recycle these modules. So it is a priority for the industry, and we're seeing a lot of progress there.
Nick Hyla, their executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, as we continue this conversation. And thank you to Larry Susskind, environmental planning professor at MIT. Larry, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
You can call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Midwest states are leading boldly on renewable energy, according to the Natural Resources Defense Council. But Midwest grid operators have more work to do to align the grid with clean energy. As we examine the path forward for solar projects, call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Hyla is here, executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association that is based in Wisconsin. So, Nick, stepping back for a moment, what is the regulatory approval process in Wisconsin for solar farms?
Yeah, so we have what's called a site and acquire process, which is somewhat unique in that most of these projects are developed by private developers with a handshake agreement with the utility to assume control and ownership of the project once complete. And so that developer comes up with a plan. They surely need to meet with the county boards and local townships and conform to local planning and zoning rules. Not all developers are created equally. So some developers are very good at developing joint development agreements that provide good neighbor payments to landowners, fund scholarship programs, fund education programs at local schools, donate panels to local municipalities, do all of the things that help build local support, which is, necessary or, probably a good move on a developer's part, because the Public Service Commission then goes through a approval process that includes public comment and review, that requires full plans be set and a vote from a majority of commissioners to approve the projects. There have been instances in Wisconsin and in neighboring states in Minnesota where the commission has said, you need to do a little more work to get more local support before we approve this project. But for the most part, all of the projects have been pretty swiftly approved.
But there has been litigation in this area of solar farms. The proposed 300-megawatt Koshkonong solar farm in Dane County that would cover more than 2,000 acres. And there's also been objections to a 250-megawatt farm in Portage County. What problems are coming up with, these types of Wisconsin projects?
Yeah, I don't know that there's problems per se. Mm-hmm. I think there are concerns. These facilities are, there's no moving parts. They're pretty close to the ground. I think they're not very visible for the most part. They're not a major, a large wind turbine. They're not kind of a visual obstruction in the landscape. I think mostly it's just the change and misunderstanding. And, there is resistance, but what you'll see is that the majority of comments submitted are relatively supportive. I think there's just concerns that concerns aren't being met, that property values might be affected, that farmland will come out of production. But the challenge right now is that those county boards and local townships and stakeholders that are best organized and best have planned for this development, have updated their planning and zoning to accommodate and incentivize these facilities to be put in certain locations, that are engaged, that are prepared to negotiate. Those jurisdictions are getting the best deal. And so I think, you know, a message for your listeners is really that, you know, it had been, you know, Wisconsin doesn't have shale oil reserves. We're not like Pennsylvania or Wyoming or North Dakota. But if we were, every single local jurisdiction would have been prepared to ensure that the developers of those oil and gas resources protect the local environment, maximize economic development, and reduce local impact. Now everybody sits under the sun. And so it's very important for jurisdictions to realize that these projects are coming. They provide a tremendous economic development opportunity, and they provide public participation risk. And that risk needs to be managed and leveraged in many instances for the maximum benefit to local people for these new developments.
Let's bring on a call. Timothy in Madison. Timothy, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yes, good morning. You're having a really interesting discussion, and I guess my concern is natural resources. And Wisconsin may not have oil or shale, but Wisconsin has got natural resources, and that's my concern. And two things. One, you know, they talk about some of these areas, wastelands. Well, for instance, in central Wisconsin, we've got a lot of good grasslands there, and there's the prairie chicken land, which that's a threatened species in Wisconsin, and there are some proposals to put in solar panels over these grasslands. And what will that do to the prairie chickens and the natural the wildlife that's there? That's one of my concerns. But then also the transmission of the power. You know, these power lines, when they have to get the power from a regular power station or the solar, the power lines, the power line people go in during the summer in July, August. They're mowing and they're mulching the native species that are underneath there. And if we're concerned about things like monarchs, the milkweed, that's where the only thing that monarchs, which are proposed possibly for an endangered species, that they lay their eggs on. And so they interrupt that. And what we need is for the power line companies, I think, to be working with the private landowners to encourage them to get that land in prairie species, and they would be less maintenance, and it would really be good for wildlife. In fact, there's going to be a question on that this spring in the Conservation Congress hearings in April. Every citizen in Wisconsin can vote on a question, which is saying that they shouldn't be mowing during the summer, and also then they should work with the private landowners. What we need...
And Timothy, I just want to jump in here and have Nick say a few words on understanding the full health of an ecosystem as to where you place solar and how you maintain solar farms.
Yeah, those are all good points. You know, I think backing up a bit, you know, our energy use has consequences. We are the most energy wasteful nation on Earth per capita. We use a tremendous amount of energy. We take that use for granted, and that there are consequences to that. These decisions don't exist in a vacuum. You know, we are transitioning. You know, the general political diatribe is that somehow wind and solar development is killing coal-fired power plants. That's not true. Natural gas development is what's threatened the profitability of coal plants. So has just the increased expense of owning and operating coal facilities. We're retiring coal plants all across the country. The average age of our nuclear fleet is over 40 years old, and wind and solar are by far the cheapest electrons on the grid. In that context, the question becomes, should we be a nation of not in my backyard? Should we pretend that we can enjoy all of the benefits of our electricity and energy privilege without any of the consequences? I think the answer is very clearly no, and people need to accept that. Now, can we develop these facilities in a way that maximize wildlife benefit and minimize harm? Absolutely. We know how to do it. There are guidelines for pollinator-friendly and wildlife-friendly solar installations, as well as wind facilities. The Nature Conservancy and others have looked at this very intensively. And all of that is easily done, again, through community engagement and requirements for the development of these facilities to be sensitive to these situations, and including with the prairie chicken habitat in central Wisconsin. All of this is integrated quite easily. I would make a point, you know, that there's a lot of hand-wringing over the loss of farmland, which I understand, but nearly half of all of the corn production in Wisconsin is corn ethanol. That's not food. That's energy. And corn ethanol is a net loser for energy in to energy out. A recent study commissioned by Clean Wisconsin looked at the energy productivity of a solar facility as compared to corn ethanol. And it's 10 times as energy productive. It has 10 times the energy return on investment as corn ethanol. No groundwater pollution, no fertilizer requirements, no pesticides, no herbicides. And so there are real positive benefits of solar development. But again, this isn't going to be gifted to us. This, you know, the future belongs to people who organize and intelligently engage to maximize the benefit of these type of investments.
Nick Hyla with us, Executive Director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, that is based in Wisconsin, as we discuss the solar energy future, installations, and solar companies. You can join in. Questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Nick, you know, Wisconsin residents paid tens of thousands of dollars for solar systems from Sun Badger Solar, and WPR is reporting the company stopped operations last year, leaving many customers with nothing to show for their money. Has that company's failure damaged the potential for solar power?
I would say yes. You know, solar is a referral business. It's really solar adoption is related to proximity and affinity. If your neighbor gets solar and has a good experience, then you're likely to. If someone that goes to your church or someone that's, parent that you go to sports with, goes solar and they have a good experience, then you're likely to. And the same is true for bad experiences. And companies like Sun Badger give the industry a bad name. You know, we are a member association of over 2,000 members across the Midwest. Many of them work in the energy industry, are solar installers. We know what quality solar installations look like. And so it's really important from a consumer standpoint to make sure that you're getting what you pay for. And consumer protection is really a big priority of ours now because, you know, in this context of the conversation, you know, not all solar is created equal. As Professor Susskind was saying, you know, these large-scale solar farms are transmission-connected, they're utility-owned, and they basically serve as baseload power that sends electricity into the grid, which we purchase as ratepayers. Rooftop solar, backyard solar, customer-owned solar, that's solar that we own. That directly offsets the electricity we purchase. No utility owns it. No utility investor gets their rate of return off of it. This extends the investment into our electricity system to anybody that has a home or business or land with a suitable site. And these assets serve as energy efficiency. They actually deter the construction of new solar farms because the less electricity we use in the distribution system and the more smartly we can use it and control the way that we use electricity, the less we have to build and the less we have to pay for. The utilities have to build, the less ratepayers have to pay for it. So it's absolutely critically important that in this competitive open market where any home or business can pursue a solar investment, that we ensure that those investments are long-lasting and that those customers are well-served.
Nick Hyla leads the Wisconsin-based Midwest Renewable Energy Association. As we discuss solar power, call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore major increases in solar generation nationwide and capacity on the electric grid with dozens of solar companies in Wisconsin, according to Renew Wisconsin. Nick Hyla is Executive Director of Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Let's go to Frank now in La Crosse. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. So my comments parallel Nick's comments. I think everybody's talked about the problems of siting in rural areas, either wind farms or solar farms, because of the loss of land, and then the transmission of the power generated by either type of facility to the urban and suburban areas. And currently, the Public Service Commission is allowing these utility companies through the transmission companies to charge ratepayers instead of stockholders. So my suggestion is, as Nick suggested, put the power generation in the hands of the private owners. And my suggestion, there's a lot of warehouse space in urban and suburban areas. Those large rooftop areas are sitting there just asking for an alternative income generation for their real estate business. So the program should generate incentives to site solar power on these rooftops of these large urban suburban warehouse roofs. That way the power is right there and you've generated additional income for the real estate owners and you don't have the problems of using up rural land and charging ratepayers for transmission.
Frank,
and that's the way that the Public Service Commission currently favors the corporate energy generators as opposed to ratepayers.
Frank, thank you for calling in and sharing that scenario and suggestion. Let's now go to Elizabeth in Eau Claire. Elizabeth, what is your idea?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm actually traveling down the interstate listening to the show, and I'd like the comments so far. But the logistics of starting a huge solar farm that takes up many, many acres has got to be kind of nightmarish in getting the power from the solar panels to the grid to disseminate it to public use. Also, road accesses have to be made, and it's a big endeavor. We already have probably thousands of acreage in between the northbound and southbound lanes on the interstate where the land and environment's already been disrupted. Why don't we put the solar panel farm right down the middle of the interstate? There's a power grid up and down there. There's already lines that can be lagged onto. It won't further disrupt the environment. There's huge road access, lots of acreage already government-owned. Put it down the middle of the interstate in between the north and southbound lanes.
Elizabeth, thank you as well. Nick Hyla, what comes up as you hear about interstate median panel solar farms and warehouse panel incentives?
Yeah, the biggest return on investment for our state and for ratepayers in general, which we all, pay an electricity bill, whether that's embodied in the goods that we use or directly, is facilitating customer investments in the distribution system that produce the electricity where it's used and that make the distribution system smarter, right? Our grid has had, for the last 100-plus years, one simple operating parameter, which is supply must equal demand or failure occurs. And we have, to date, not invested significantly in managing our demand and instead have overbuilt capacity to make sure that we can supply this variable, uncontrolled demand. And we pay for all that extra capacity. Now we have the opportunity with rooftop solar and batteries and energy efficiency and electrification to better manage the demand and to better leverage private investments in the distribution system. And that needs to be a public policy priority across the country if we're going to reduce costs over the long term. When it comes to some of these more innovative investments, You know, we are trapped by our past infrastructure investments. We're trapped by the way we've built them and the debts we've owed. And nothing was built to accept solar. You know, we have a difficult time just building and operating roads, much less solar roads. And so I think it's a very innovative idea, but I wouldn't say that it's the lowest hanging fruit here. You know, warehouse roofs, absolutely. Parking lots, definitely. Landfill sites and Superfund sites should have solar. Unusable land that's close to energy infrastructure, absolutely. And so I think with looking at our energy future, the amount of energy that we use, the amount of electricity we'll use throughout the future, this is an all-hands-on-deck effort. It's also a tremendous opportunity to rebuild the fundamental underpinnings of our economy in a way that is more open and more beneficial and more distributed. And I think that there are a lot of ways to do that, but probably, well, absolutely, the highest return on investment is helping ratepayers themselves, homes and businesses, do it for themselves.
So what could the Wisconsin governor, Governor Evers, and the legislature do to encourage more investment in solar energy and be in the ballpark of achieving net zero emissions by 2050?
Well, I guess the question is, what do the executive and legislative branches ever do together nowadays? I think, you know, we need a clear and shared vision. One interesting bill is a community solar bill that's in committee. It's actually introduced and sponsored by Republicans. I have a feeling that if it would ever get out of committee and get a vote, it would actually attract quite a bit of support across the aisle and get a signature from Governor Evers. And what that bill would allow is for private development of smaller scale solar facilities, 5 megawatts or less, and businesses to invest directly in them and get the benefits of the electricity production mediated on their electricity bill. This has been a tremendous economic boom for the Twin Cities in Minnesota, with over 800 megawatts of community solar being developed, and the vast majority of it serving business customers that not only get to reduce their electricity bills, but market their net zero electricity and all do it within their business service territory. Businesses in Wisconsin are clamoring for it. The Wisconsin Grocers Association is a big supporter. And so there are opportunities here where we could see some bipartisan support for bills that really open up Wisconsin's economy for advantageous local clean electricity development.
Nick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nick Hyla is Executive Director of Midwest Renewable Energy Association. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show is produced by Courtney Everett, Trevor Hook, Mackenzie Crummy, Joel Patnod, Royce Padeswa, Avery Rogers, and Joe Tarr. Lee Rayburn is our technical director, and Keegan Kyle is interim executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.